I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Our guest this evening is Brian Forster. He's a researcher, an author who studies ancient sites. His website is located at hiddenincatours.com. And Brian is focused on finding out man's hidden history. And I think this is very important because so much of our disorientation is because we really don't understand who we are and what has happened on the earth. And Brian has written something like 16 books, which is an amazing accomplishment. I'll read just a few of the titles. Akhenaten. The second book, Aftershock, The Ancient Cataclysm That Erased Human History. The Plumed Serpent, Ancient Bearded Gods of Americas, Elongated Skulls of Peru and Bolivia, The Path of Viracocha. The Lost Ancient Technology of Peru and Bolivia is the fifth book, and I think there are 10 others at least. And the books are available in written and electronic forms at hiddenincatours.com. And I think a lot of the standard normal books are also available on Amazon. And Brian, I'd like to welcome you to the show. You really have an amazing body of work.
Thank you.
And just take a few minutes and tell our listeners how you started down this path. I imagine you've experienced a tremendous amount of challenges along the way. And try to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I've always been fascinated by ancient mysteries since I was a child. The first megalithic site I guess I ever saw was Stonehenge when I was about 16. I pursued an academic career in the sciences, especially biology, but after I graduated, I decided not to do that and pursued my childhood interest in native West Coast art, as in carving totem poles and things. And then over a period of time, my interest switched to Polynesia, so I moved to Hawaii and worked on a major canoe project there for a couple of years, traveled through Polynesia, and then decided to visit Peru just because it seemed interesting. And as soon as I got to the city of Cusco, then I found many megalithic sites that standard academia couldn't explain, and that caused me to basically move here.
How long have you been in Peru?
I first came here about 13 years ago. I've been living here full time for about 8 years.
You know, that takes a lot of courage to go out and follow your instincts like that and move to a different country and everything. How were you guided to do that?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. It's just when I moved to Hawaii, I sold my house in Canada and most of my possessions, wound up with a box 4 feet by 4 feet by 8 feet that had all of my possessions, and then I moved back to Canada, and when I moved to Peru, it was basically the same thing. I was just drawn by my curiosity, a sense of wanting to do something important in my life. So once again, I wound up with a box of what I found to be precious possessions. Everything else was sold off, and now, of course, I've collected a pile of more stuff living in Peru.
So you're originally from Canada then, right?
Yeah, I was born in the U.S., but I grew up in Canada.
So you've lived, I would say, a long time with probably out any pets or, I don't even, are you married?
Yes, I am. I'm married to a Peruvian lady.
Okay. So that just takes a tremendous amount of courage, and I'm glad you had the courage to do that, because one of the things that I really think is that we don't really know who we are or where we come from or what the real history on the earth is. And I think what you're doing is extremely important. Could you kind of comment on that statement?
I think you're very correct in that. We've been educated in schools that teach some truths, but there are many truths that we have not been taught. And it actually takes an individual to go out and explore, because academia teaches us some things, but they ignore a lot of other things that don't fit their paradigm. And those bits that they haven't taught us are actually very important to the history of humanity.
Let me start out with a quote from Giorgio Tsoukalos, and I'd be interested to hear your take on this. And this comes from a Coast to Coast show that was done back in 2011, July 31st. I think it was the third hour of the show, about 16 minutes in or so. He said, Giorgio said, there's an ancient manuscript from Egypt called the Al-Hittat that says the pyramids were built by the Egyptians with the assistance of the guardians of the sky or the watchers from heaven. Can you comment on that?
I'm not actually, I've never heard of that manuscript, but what I can tell you from four trips to Egypt and my fifth coming up in March is that it's clear that such structures as the Great Pyramids were not made by the dynastic Egyptians because they simply didn't have the technology. The dynastic Egyptians were a Bronze Age culture up until about the 7th century BC. And they could not have cut any of the granite or basalt stone that we find in the Great Pyramid and at other sites in Egypt.
So let's start with Aswan, which is the quarry, the great stone quarry that a lot of the granite came out of. And a lot of the obelisks and these colossal statues came out of Aswan. And I think by definition, granite has about 20% quartz at least. Is that correct?
Yeah, 20 to 30% quartz. And quartz has a hardness of 7 out of 10, with 10 being diamond, and bronze is about 3.5.
There's another great researcher, Nassim Haramein, who said it's very hard to explain the building of the pyramids using vine ropes, copper tools, no pulley, and so on. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, it is simply impossible. It doesn't matter how many people you have working. The accuracy, the finesse, and the scale of something like the Great Pyramid would be very difficult for us to do today with cranes and industrial helicopters and diamond saws and things. So there is no way that the dynastic Egyptians could have done that work.
And in one of your films in Egypt, you were at Elephantine Island, which I guess is near Aswan, off of the Nile River. And you pointed to this large block that was laying on the ground. It had a pointed top. The surface was very smooth. It had some lines cut in it. And you called it a super ancient artifact. Could you tell us why did you call that? Why is that so ancient?
Well, the fact that the dynastic Egyptians could not have made that means that we're looking at a culture that is obviously older. And so scientifically and geologically, we're looking at a time frame of about 12,000 years ago when there was a cataclysmic event that impacted the entire planet. So we're likely looking at a civilization at least 12,000 years old that did this kind of work.
Do you think this civilization might even be more ancient, say 40, 50, 60, 70,000 years old, potentially?
It could be. All I can say is that this major cataclysmic event that happened was between 11,700 and 11,900 years ago. So the culture had to be older, but we can't be more specific than simply saying pre-cataclysmic at this point.
So can we talk a little bit about that? You have a whole book about that, right?
Yeah.
So was it an asteroid that came in? What exactly was this great cataclysm?
Well, there are different theories. One theory is that it was a comet that either impacted the planet or came very close and caused gravitational pull that altered the axis of the planet, quite possibly. Another theory by Robert Schock, who's a geologist, is that it was actually plasma ejection from the sun. Hmm. And then there's another theory by Paul Laviolette, who believes that every 13,000 years approximately, there's an eruption from our galactic center. He doesn't believe that our galactic core is a black hole, but instead is a pulsar. So it's possible, via his theory, that there was this ejection of energy that crossed the galactic plane and could have caused comets to be pulled into the path, either striking or coming close to the Earth. The energy also could have gone through the sun and caused the plasma ejection. So that's basically what the book is looking at.
So we may get thrown back to the Stone Age every 12,000 years or so?
Yeah, approximately every 12 to 13,000.
That's interesting. What are your thoughts on reincarnation?
Actually, I'm not quite sure. I was born quite psychic. I have had past life regression, but whether it's real or not, I'm not sure. It is possible that I've simply been picking up ancient messages and energy at these sites themselves, which has caused me to believe that I was in a certain location in a past life. But I do have attraction to certain ancient cultures around the world that makes me feel it's possible that I did have past lives in these places.
Very interesting. So you talk about evidence of machine tools used in ancient Egypt. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, actually, the evidence is overwhelming in locations like the Giza Plateau and where the other ancient pyramids are. We see things like drill holes that were done by core drills, which is a hollow tube. And engineers have looked at these holes, and they say that whatever kind of drill was used was 500 times more efficient than a modern 21st century drill. And then we also find saw marks, which is evidence of circular saws that could have been at least 20 feet in diameter.
Jeez. So which do you find more spectacular, ancient Egypt or Pumapunku?
Well, ancient Egypt for its scale, because the Great Pyramid, for example, is 500 feet tall, and you feel like an ant when you're on location. These things are absolutely huge in size. But Pumapunku is probably, on some level, my favorite location, just because no academic can explain anything about it. It's simply, it appears like it was a one-off construction. There's nothing else on the planet that looks like it. And I've been there more than 50 times. And every time I learn a little bit more about what maybe was going on there.
And aren't some of the stones at Pumapunku actually radioactive?
We haven't been able to read radioactivity, but magnetism is really prominent there. All you have to do is take a compass and move it across the front of one of the famous H blocks, and you'll see the polarity will switch by 180 degrees, sometimes more than two or three times. It's very odd.
So it's almost like some kind of, maybe, and this is pure speculation, some kind of energy was used on these blocks in the ancient past?
Yeah, it's possible that the magnetism that remains is could have been the result of how the stone was transported from the quarry, which is about 45 miles away, and also possibly part of the function of the stones themselves when they were properly in place.
And the quarry at Pumapunku is actually behind a mountain, right?
Yeah, it's on top of a volcano.
So there's no way that mainstream can come up with a way that they could transport those blocks, right?
Not anything which is logical. The problem is that a lot of academics come up with their own theories without consulting someone like a shipwright or an engineer or someone like that. The standard story is that they built giant reed rafts of some kind to carry these 40-ton plus blocks from the quarry, which again is about 45 miles away.
And they had to go down a mountain, over a mountain, with these giant blocks?
Yeah, they had to come down from the top of the volcano to the shore of Lake Titicaca and then be moved from there by some kind of ship or boat. The problem is that there's no native trees at that elevation, so that's why they came out with the Totora reed idea. But you'd have to have a massive raft in order to transport something like that.
And what comes to my mind is that would be so incredibly dangerous.
Well, that too. I mean, number one is how did they cut the blocks from the top of the mountain? How did they transport them down to the lake shore? How did they move them onto these so-called reed boats? And then how did they maneuver the boat or the raft from there south and then move them another 7 miles in order to get them into the present location?
It's very interesting. I think people hold so tightly on their worldview that they're not even willing to objectively evaluate evidence that may cause them to change that worldview.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I tend to consult with people like engineers who come on our tours. The main function of the tour is actually for me to get more information. So we've had many engineers and machinists and physicists and people like that come with us, and I simply ask them their opinion. For example, at Pumapunku, how do you think these stones were transported? Why is there magnetism, etc.?
So, is it just my imagination, or is there some ancient site somewhere where you guys found radioactivity?
I don't have a Geiger counter to be able to measure that yet. I'm hoping that there will be a decent app for my phone at some point to be able to do that, because that would be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, very, very much so. So, if they had machine tools in the ancient past, does that imply that they had electricity or other machines that could be used for moving, like something like an automobile or some kind of flying vehicle?
They would have to have had some kind of energy powerful enough to be able to to power these machines, these obvious drills and saws that we found. Electricity is the most obvious, but it would be these would be very, very powerful machines requiring an enormous amount of energy.
Can you tell us about the Colossi of Memnon?
Sure, I've been fascinated by those since I was a child, looking at photographs in National Geographic, etc. And what I didn't notice until I was actually on location is that the one which is on the left is one piece of stone on top of a platform, which is one piece of stone. And it's been estimated that the main block that the figure is made out of weighs 720 tons and was moved about 400 miles from a quarry near Cairo.
That's absolutely amazing. And I've heard you talk about what the word pyramid means in ancient Egypt, something like house of energy or something like that.
Yeah, that's actually what distinguishes the seven or so super ancient pyramids in Egypt from all the other pyramidal structures that you find around the world. And that's when the Greeks first arrived in Egypt, conquering the people there, they obviously wanted to know, learn the language and learn the names of different things. And so they interpreted the word Perneter, which means the house of energy, to being, they switched it to Pyramidos, which means the fire within or the energy within. So they were being given the description of the original function of a pyramid, which was an energetic structure. But unfortunately, people now use the term pyramid to describe structures in places like Mexico and Central America and other locations on the planet, whereas a true pyramido is located in Egypt exclusively.
Does sound play any role in those pyramids in Egypt?
Yeah, sound and vibration, definitely.
So, how does that play out? I mean, how was sound used in these ancient pyramids? Do we know?
We're still trying to figure that out, but when you're inside the Red Pyramid or the Great Pyramid or the other two that are on the Giza Plateau, our main guide, Yusuf Awiyan, is an expert at toning, and so when he hits the right pitch or tone, he's able to make these different chambers vibrate. You can tell that because the sound level goes way up when he hits the right pitch. So it seems like these chambers were specifically tuned for sound.
Is there any area in the Great Pyramid that's off limits to the public?
Well, they seemingly have found two new possible chambers, which have either been blocked off or are not accessible through the main shaft system. But every time we go, we have access for 2 hours exclusively into the kings, queens, and subterranean chambers.
So why is our history being hidden from us?
I think mainly because knowledge is power. And so there are those that do not wish humanity to understand their true origins, as well as how powerful we are as beings. But slowly this is leaking away, thanks to the internet. But as well, there are a lot of academics who filter information. If certain things don't fit their paradigm, then they are ignored. But we're unraveling all of that now.
Do you think there is an elite group on the planet that knows our real history?
Yeah, I do, but I think they're losing their grasp now, so it won't be too long before we'll be able to learn everything we want to know.
Now, there's a lot of giant skeletons that have been unearthed in my area of the country, and that's another thing that's extremely covered up. Have you studied the whole giant skeleton aspect of things?
A little bit. Certain associates of mine, like Hugh Newman and L.A. Marzulli, are much more knowledgeable, but there is a lot of circumstantial evidence that in the 19th century, especially institutions like the Smithsonian, covered up the idea or covered up any actual physical evidence of large humanoids living, especially in North America, around places like Ohio, of course.
Right.
And also, I think New Mexico and all many different areas. So supposedly hundreds of large skeletons have been collected by different institutions and are warehoused and are not accessible by anybody.
Now, these elongated skulls that you've been studying, do you think that these are skulls from maybe an ancient race that were on the earth? Have you been able to draw any conclusions from those?
Well, we're getting closer and closer. When you ask, especially a Peruvian archaeologist, those that are being truthful, if they know the origin of where this culture called the Paracas came from, they simply say, we don't know. They seem to have just appeared about 900 BC and then disappeared about 100 AD. So through scientific analysis, we're starting to figure out, and through historical records, that these people average about 6 feet tall, which is big in comparison to even Peruvians of modern day. They had natural red wavy hair, and we're just starting to do the DNA testing now. But the initial results of the DNA testing show origins in Northern Europe or the Mesopotamia area. So they were not people who crossed the Bering Land Bridge with all the other Native Americans.
Do you think these skulls indicate they might have had a larger IQ?
The volume of some of the crania are about 25 to 30% larger than a normal person of this area. So it is quite possible that they had not only higher intelligence, but higher functions of thinking and processing and possibly psychic power as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Makes me wonder if they had abilities like ESP or telekinesis and things like that.
Could be.
Now, are these skulls found in, I know they're found down there in Peru. Do you think they're also found in Egypt? Is there evidence in Egypt?
Unfortunately, they're only depictions of them. They're statues and wall paintings and carvings during the Amarna period of Akhenaten that show elongated skulls. But as far as I can tell, or at least I've never seen an actual skull in Egypt that portrays those features.
Now, did Akhenaten have an elongated skull?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know because his mummy has never been found. There is a mummy in the Cairo Museum that is listed as being Akhenaten, but there's been no genetic or DNA testing to prove that. I think actually that Akhenaten and Nefertiti have not been found.
Oh, that's interesting. Is it Akhenaten that's depicted with the green skin, or is that Osiris?
That's Osiris.
Do you think Osiris was a real person or just an invented deity or whatever?
No, I think Akhenaten was, or I think Osiris and Isis were real beings. Yeah, and I think that's what Akhenaten was trying to do is by portraying himself sometimes and his daughters especially with these horizontally elongated heads. I think he was trying to tell the public, this is our origin. This is where we came from.
Oh, that's so interesting. And were the skull depictions in Egypt different than the skulls that you're seeing in Peru? Are they kind of, they go back a little bit?
Yeah, they're actually quite different in shape. I just posted on Facebook today, actually, one of the heads from Egypt and then one of the skulls from Paracas. The ones from Egypt are swept backwards. Whereas the Paracas are literally cone heads, they're vertically elongated.
And this is pure speculation. Do you think there's any chance that these people are still alive on the earth and maybe they went underground or something?
I don't know, but the funny thing is that this lady who happened to be Canadian lady who happened to be visiting the Nazca area, which is just south of where I am in Paracas, she took a photograph of a man at a bank machine who had an elongated head. And so she sent that to me. That's the only one I've seen that looks like that,
Was
but it
it
was quite odd.
pretty exaggerated? I mean, it wasn't just unusual. I mean, it was pretty big, right?
Yeah, it was larger than normal. I wouldn't say huge, but it seemed to be elongated
And
on some level.
did he have a hat on or anything?
No, he didn't.
That's interesting. So, a lot of these statues in Egypt are huge. Like, there's one of Ramses II, this colossal statue. It weighs 83 tons, about 165,000 pounds. I think they have it inside some structure maybe now. And I've seen f incredible photographs of it. It's limestone, I believe. It depicts a very handsome and muscular kind of pharaoh. Have you seen the particular statue I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's actually in Memphis, and it's lying down. There are many statues which have the cartouche of Ramses II on them, but the inside story about that is that, in fact, the granite ones which were found and are incredibly beautiful and finely finished were literally found during the time of Ramses II, buried underground, and so his priests and other people. Once they discovered these, they asked Ramses II if they wanted, or if he wanted his cartouche carved onto them. So they're much older than Ramses the Second.
Wow. So he took credit for that, like it's him, but it really wasn't.
Yeah, he took credit for a lot of stuff. That's one of the reasons he's so famous, is that he had his cartouche or his name or title carved onto surfaces all over the place, stating, this is mine.
Goodness. That, do they have any idea how old that statue is?
Well, that one's limestone, so it actually could have been carved during dynastic times because limestone you can shape with bronze tools, but the granite ones could not have been, so they are much, much older.
But I mean, this particular one we're talking about is incredibly beautiful. The workmanship is amazing.
It is.
I always wondered about that one. Another, oh, one thing I wanted to throw out. A lot of these statues are really huge. Do you think the Egyptians might have, I mean, the ancient Egyptians, I don't even know if that's the right thing to call them. Do you think they might have been giants?
Unfortunately, we haven't found a skeleton. It is possible, but some of the ones that in the area of Thebes are at least 20 feet tall, and again, they're made out of granite, and they're just so perfectly done that it's unlikely that they could have been done with hand tools. It looks like power tools had to have been used to make them.
Yeah, they're just incredibly beautiful. What about these 20 plus giant stone boxes that are found in, is it called Saqqara?
Saqqara is the name of one of the largest archaeological sites in the world, actually. So it's huge, but the specific location is called the Serapeum, which is a series of two underground tunnels with these niches in which these, I think it's 27 boxes are deposited, each weighing 100 tons each.
And it's probably just pure speculation. We don't even know what these things are used for, do we?
No, we have no idea. Again, the standard answer is that they were made by the dynastic Egyptians for as sarcophagi for ceremonial bulls called Apis bulls, but no bull remains have ever been or were found in them. When I think the French archaeologist Mariette first discovered the site in the 19th century. Also, the lids seem to have been partially removed, as if whatever was inside of them was either taken out before that time or escaped that before that time.
Wow. You know, some of these explanations, they almost remind me of a psyop or something. You know what I mean? Like some,
Yeah, it's
almost like they're intentionally created to cause confusion or demoralization, or it's just absurd. I mean, why would anyone? I mean, these things are incredible. Why would you construct this incredible stone structure to put bones of a bull in? It's just absurd.
It is well. It is absurd, and according to the 19th century documents, there was one the mummified body of a bull that was found somewhere in the area, and then it was moved to, I believe, the Agricultural Museum in Cairo. But our great guide Mohammed Ibrahim actually went to the museum last year. And asked them about it, and they said, "We have no idea what you're talking about. We don't have any mummified bull here."
Are there some local people in Egypt that are starting to speak out a little more about these structures? I mean, it seems like most of the government of Egypt hands us the same old BS stories, right?
Yeah, they do. And again, that's the great thing about the internet is that we can make videos and put them on YouTube, and nobody can do anything about it. And we have the greatest consultants and guides who live in Egypt and were born in Egypt who actually carry the oral tradition, some of it being from pre-dynastic times.
Oh, the oral tradition. There's an oral
Yeah.
tradition.
There is.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's this oral tradition dates back more than 4,500 years, or actually more than 5,000 years, because it's about 5,000 years ago when what we call the dynastic Egyptians first appeared in Egypt, and that is something that Egyptologists will agree with. But we're talking about oral traditions and knowledge which predate that. So this is knowledge of the probably the original builders.
Have you ever heard of a part of the Egyptian history that's referred to as the information related to the Sky Kings?
Not so much, no. Again, Osiris, is an interesting character, and there are those in Egypt who believe that he was a living being, and that in fact he came from the star system of Sirius.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, why did they ch choose Cirrus?
Well, they believe it's Sirius. One of the reasons is because the Sphinx is actually looking at the rising of Sirius. And we know that the Sphinx, based on geological weathering, is more than 10,000 years old. So it, again, was not made by the dynastic Egyptians. They found it when they arrived in Egypt 5,000 years ago, as well as the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau and the Serapeum and parts of Karnak, you know, etc.
Doesn't the star system of Orion also play some role in Egypt?
It does. According to researchers such as Robert Bovall, he believes that the three big pyramids on the Giza Plateau represent the Belt of Orion. And there are other certain references to Orion as well.
What's the main focus of your research right now?
I'm in Paracas in Peru right now, and we're awaiting an agreement by the Peruvian Ministry of Culture to allow us to export samples from the elongated skulls of Paracas to be DNA tested in two major labs in North America.
Awesome.
And then in March, we return to Egypt for our fifth annual Lost Ancient Technology and Spirituality Tour. Then in May, I may be going to England and Ireland looking at megalithic sites, as well as going to Contact in the Desert, which is at Joshua Tree in California. And on it goes.
Contact in the Desert, is that related to Dr. Stephen Greer at all?
Actually, he's going to be there this year. I'll have a chance to meet him.
Wow. Interesting. So, if I remember correctly, isn't there evidence of something beneath Pumapunku?
Yeah, actually, I think it was 2007. They did ground-penetrating radar testing, and they found at least one quite large chamber located, or at least hollow space, under Pumapunku. And as well in the area of Tiwanaku, which is next door, it's actually part of the same complex, it's believed that there are other chambers which are underground there as well.
You know, back to your elongated skulls with the DNA test, it's my theory, just my theory based on some things I've read and research that I've done, that I think there are human beings. I don't think Earth is the only place that has human beings on it. So I'm wondering if, I mean, they could do a DNA test on these skulls and they could show as human beings, but with just a very fine variation, maybe slightly different DNA or just slightly different genetics than just your average human being, right?
Yeah, well, the basic DNA testing that is done first is simply, it cross-references the DNA which is found with that which is known. And so that's why somebody living today can have their DNA tested and they can, to their surprise, find out that they're 6% Chinese when they're, you know, when they look Caucasian, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But it basically references what is known. So the problem is that if it possibly finds something which is not known, that's where it becomes even more interesting, but that's a much more complex process.
Right, right. So do you have any speculation yourself, or do you not like to go there?
At this point, I believe that whoever these people were probably lived in the Middle East area and were forced out by an invading army or people of some kind. They took to ships and they headed eastwards and went through all of basically lower Southeast Asia through Polynesia and then wound up on the coast of Peru. They found refuge there because there was basically no one living there. And they thrived until the so-called Nazca culture invaded from the north and more or less wiped them out.
Wasn't there a cataclysm in Peru as well?
Definitely. The 12,000-year-old cataclysm that we're looking at, there's definite signs of major destruction to the megalithic sites that we find. And so that's why we tend to date the ancient sites of Peru and Bolivia and also Egypt as being most likely contemporary.
Interesting. So can you tell us a little bit about the unfinished obelisk in Egypt?
Yeah, that's one of the most obvious examples of something that the dynastic Egyptians couldn't have done, because it's If it was ever finished, it would have been 1,200 tons. And one problem is, how were they planning on getting it out of the pit in which they were carving it? The other thing is, standard academia says that dolerite pounders, which are basically oval or round stones, were used in order to be as the chief tool for removing the granite material. But we have a geologist that comes with us every time, and she said the hardness of dolerite is only slightly more than that of granite. So basically, the pounders would have fallen apart quite rapidly. And the pits are about 8 feet deep, so that's a lot of work.
To say the least.
And then supposedly, you lift this thing, which is 1,200 tons, out of the pit that it's in. Then you move it across a very uneven, rocky landscape, and then you're supposed to move it to the Nile, and then build some kind of boat to transport it. And there are no trees in Egypt except date palms, as far as I know. So when you go to the quarry, there is a little museum that you go into, and they play about a 10-minute video. The voiceover is done by Omar Sharif, and this, it's just complete nonsense. So definitely, that's an example of something that was being shaped probably in the pre-cataclysmic period, and then work all of a sudden stopped. So it is possible that the cataclysm interrupted it and might have even killed all the workers that were there.
And it's so perfect when you see those photographs. I mean, it's just perfectly cut out, exactly, just perfect. It's a stunning thing.
Yeah, it is. And also the finished ones, there are some beautiful ones at Karnak and other locations. And what you can tell from them is that you can see that the dynastic Egyptians found them and simply carved hieroglyphs all over them. They didn't shape them to begin with. So originally, the obelisks would not have had any writing on them whatsoever. They were just beautiful, sacred geometrical shapes.
You know, and it seems to me the logical thing is they would have to have been transported by air, but you know, the question is how would they do such a thing, right?
Yeah, that is what we're looking at. How is it possible? In the case of Puma Punku, the gray stone is naturally has what is it? Magnetite in it. But in terms of the granite ones, it's possible that you're looking at, or you would focus on something like the quartz content and being able to vibrate that, possibly in order to reduce the effect of gravity or something like that. That's the more or less the central focus of our trip now to Egypt, is to figure out the chemical and other properties of the stone itself, to see if there's something in there that would allow us to.
Yeah, Brian, it looks like we're breaking up here. I kind of lost you.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. It's our only interruption so far, and you're all the way in Peru, so we're pretty lucky in that sense. Yeah, the unfinished obelisk is an amazing thing, and to think maybe some fantastically advanced culture. Which I think if you look at these things and you're honest with yourself, that's what you're really looking at is a fantastically advanced culture. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think it's become quite obvious that whoever did this work was actually more advanced technologically than what we are, which most people won't accept, but the evidence is there. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the saw blades in Egypt were upwards of 20 feet in diameter and a little over 3/16 of an inch thick. Now, we don't have any material in modern times to be able to make a saw of that size out of.
Now, 3/16, how wide is that? That's like the cover of a book or something.
It's less than a, well, of course, it's less than a quarter of an inch, but
That's pretty small.
Yeah, and something like that, if it was made out of even high carbon steel today, being 20 feet in diameter means that it would flop. It would be very elastic. So in order to get that thing housed into a machine and have it have you be able to turn it on and not vibrate it to the point where it would blow the machine to pieces as it was trying to stabilize itself, is incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible. Another crazy, amazing Egyptian site is the facade of the Temple of Abu Simbel. I'm pronouncing that wrong. It's 33 meters high. It depicts these four large figures in seated position. Each statue weighs 2.5 million pounds and is 67 feet tall. Who were they depicting there, Brian?
I think once again that's attributed to Ramses II. Four copies of himself.
So, do you think that, again, I'm speculating here, these are gigantic figures, and didn't they actually move that whole temple structure?
Yeah, I think it was in the 1960s, the Russians were building the High Aswan Dam, and so Abu Simbel was going to be buried underwater. So it's in, different copies of National Geographic where they sawed the whole thing into pieces and then moved it by giant cranes and then reconstructed it.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't been to Abu Simbel because due to the low tourism present in Egypt right now, there are no flights. There is actually a little airport there. So in the past, you were able to fly from Cairo right next door to Abu Simbel. But now you have to take a bus from Aswan, and that requires getting up at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And so I'm going to wait till the flights return, and then I'll go and see it. But I've heard it's absolutely incredible.
Would that be an all-day drive or something like that?
Yeah. People I know, especially those that are 6 feet and taller, are crammed into this like a van, and it's at least 4 hours to get there across the desert with no air conditioning, and then 4 hours back. So I'm going to wait for the flights to return.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all. So, and you've talked about going into the jungles of Bolivia, and one of the places that you have visited, is it called Samaipata?
Yeah, Samaipata,
Okay.
which means it's the Inca language, and it means the high resting place. And it's a megalithic construction. It's the top of a red sandstone mountain, which has been completely carved and looks very similar in design to some of the ancient megalithic sites that we find in the Sacred Valley of Peru near Cusco.
And how many times have you been there?
I was just there last month. I've been there 3 times.
Interesting. And what do you think is the most important thing from that site in terms of archaeology?
Well, again, it's got all of these recesses, which are about the size of a refrigerator or larger, and they're very similar to those that we find around the city of Cusco, which are pre-Inca constructions. And so I think whoever was working at Samaipata was also working around the Sacred Valley of Peru and Cusco. And the standard story is that 3,000 years ago, some Stone Age Amazonian people moved westward out of the Amazon and carved all of the top of this mountain. And it's like these people didn't even have metal tools. So that's another one of these silly stories based on nothing that the general public tends to swallow, and it's simply not the case. It's a very mysterious place that not that many people visit, but it's well worthwhile.
Have you visited Machu Picchu?
I was there last month for my 59th time.
Wow. Now, aren't the isn't the st aren't the stones there, they've in certain places been melted? Is that true?
That's open to further study. It's unlikely that it's actually vitrification or melting.
Mm-hmm.
It could just be high polishing. But what we do know is that the core of Machu Picchu is megalithic, and so it's something that the Inca civilization found and then built around it. So the Inca built about 90 to 95% of the Machu Picchu location, but they found something initially there, and that's what drew their interest to build there in the first place.
So what is the most amazing thing about Machu Picchu to you?
Just the sheer size and beauty. You can't see it from the valley floor, and so that's why the Spanish never found it. But when you take the 25-minute ride by bus up to the top and walk through the entrance, everyone that I've been there with is just completely blown away by its beauty, by its grandeur, its location, and its sheer scale.
So is it like up on top of a mountain?
It is.
That's interesting. So there was a very, very ancient culture that built something there, and then the Incas came and built on top of it?
Yeah, and around it. And that's the same thing that we find in the city of Cusco itself. The Inca found an abandoned megalithic city, so they made it their center. Other sites called Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, etc., which are major Inca sites, the core of each one is always something older and megalithic.
That's so interesting. So it seems like that's probably what confuses people maybe a little bit, is because you've got something very ancient, and then, you know, maybe a group comes in 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago and then builds their own little something beside it or right around it.
Yeah. Kind and that's, that obviously is also the case in Egypt too. They found near the Great Pyramid, relatively recently, they found a village which they described as being the workers' village. But it's not the workers' village who built the great, the Great Pyramid. It's the people who probably maintained the area during dynastic time. So we find that over and over again in these ancient places. You'll find a really super ancient structure, and then you'll find the famous culture that supposedly made it, but simply built around it. Karnak is a classic example. It's one of the largest of the ancient sites in Egypt. The core is ancient, megalithic, shows signs of being half melted, half blown up by a cataclysm, and then the dynastic Egyptians built a lot of stuff around it.
It's been half melted.
Yeah, actually, that was my my most recent discovery, which we're going to do a lot more work on this March, is our geologist who came with us. I noticed that rather than being damage caused by somebody, an invading army or someone deciding to break the monuments, it appeared that some of the stone surfaces had literally blown off. And so I asked her if it could have been heat, and she said yes, it could very well have been. It could be evidence of the plasma ejection from the sun, of that striking the stone surface and scorching and burning and blowing parts of it off.
Do you think we're due for another one of these cataclysms?
Hopefully not in our lifetime. But as Dr. Robert Schock says, it could be tomorrow, could be 1,000 years from tomorrow. So I'm not personally concerned about that.
Well, yeah. I don't blame you. So Karnak is that one of the most interesting places in Egypt from your perspective?
Yeah, because it's so complicated when you look at the fact that the core part is much, much older than the dynastic Egyptians. And now that I'm starting to look more at this evidence of heat, like we're talking possibly a million degrees of heat striking the stone surface, and that the ceremonial causeway, which goes from east to west, is actually 23 degrees off east-west, whereas the other structures, dynastic structures in Egypt, are almost perfectly aligned to north, south, east, and west. That could mean that These were built originally at the time when our planet was not at 23.5 degrees tilt that it is now, but was actually vertical.
See, that's very interesting. So was our planet vertical before the cataclysm?
I think so, and I think that's why we see that. I believe it's the planet Uranus is rotating on its side. One of the other planets is rotating backwards, because in a perfect solar system, everything should be vertical and should be rotating, in a vertical position. We also have the asteroid belt, which some suggest was a planet that was actually blown to pieces by this ancient cataclysm.
Do you think our planet would have had a different climate because of the vertical position of the planet?
Yeah, I think it would have had two seasons rather than four.
Oh, very interesting. Do you think it may have been warmer on our poles?
That's a good question. I think the poles have actually always been there, to some extent, but Robert Schock, again, and others have shown that the end of the last ice age, which was 12,000 years ago, was very rapid. It wasn't like the slow changing of thousands or thousands of years. It was actually very super rapid, and he personally believes that the rising of sea level as the result of the partial melting of the poles, we know that the world's oceans rose by about 300 plus feet 12,000 years ago, that could have taken 2 weeks.
Wow. That would have been pretty quick.
Very.
What, last question, what are your thoughts on the Temple of Abydos?
You mean the Osirion?
The one I'm talking about has hieroglyphs, but they almost look like a helicopter and a tank and some kind of flying vehicle. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah, and actually one looks like a sub, like it could be a submarine.
Right,
and
right.
Yeah, they do. You know, I've been there four times, and I've looked at them four times, and I've filmed them and photographed them, and they look like machines to me. Some people think that they're the complex layering of different hieroglyphs over time, but they stand out, so they're really obvious when you see them.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Please tell us about your websites and all your events coming up and your books.
Sure. My website is hiddeninkatours.com, but the tours part is only a very small percentage of what the site contains. It's a massive database. I basically have a full-time webmaster who takes care of it. So on there you'll find almost 900 videos, all of my books, lots of articles and interviews like this, etc. And basically, you know, it's all free for people to look at. The tours, of course, finance what I do, but my wife and I don't run it as a business. We run it as an adventure, and it's our firm commitment to give away the majority of the information that we learn for free, because it's the birthright of each and every one of us to learn, if we want to, where we come from.
That's awesome, Brian. Have a great day, sir, and thank you very much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Bye-bye.